Everyone's like, oh, free speech, free speech. We have controlled speech. There are words you can use, phrases you can use, words you can't use, and phrases you can't use. You can either be cancelled or, at worst, go to prison. Everything's woolly defined on purpose so they can catch you out. It's just a gotcha sort of setup.
Jeff Taylor is a UK-based YouTube content creator and commentator who focuses on analyzing news, politics, and world events. He is the voice behind a growing movement which connects thousands and builds community through direct, unfiltered engagement.
You have to have a strong society that understands and loves the country. Because if you go to war, war is a total thing. It's not, oh, the soldiers go out. Everybody's involved. Every year, the birth rate is below replacement. So when people say, oh, we need British doctors trained in Britain, you can't, if you haven't had the babies 20 years ago, to train today. And when it's at those sorts of levels, the population starts dropping, but not at the top end, at the bottom end, where they're young. So in 20 years' time, you've got too few taxpayers. If you don't have enough babies, you won't have enough workers. Therefore, you must make moves to import people to do those jobs. The judge should be totally colorblind and religious blind and all the rest of it. You've broken the law, this, and I'm going to send you down for that. The only human rights that you have, or I have, are ones that I personally can 100% protect. That's it. If you have to rely on other people who may or may not step in, where are your rights? What are your rights? The two ships' hulls are doing this all the time, almost touching. They were that close, you know, with the waves. So you just timed your jump and you jumped across. The whole point about the military is you do these really outlandish things, but you're doing them all the time. So it's just normal. Join the military. It's great fun.
Hello, 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 and welcome to this edition of the Jolly Heretic on Tour. I am in London, and I have a very special guest for you today, and that is a fellow YouTuber whom you might have heard of and campaigner, Mr. Jeff Taylor. Jeff, hello.
Hello there, and thank you for having me on your show.
Hello there. So, shall we talk in a staccato fashion?
Absolutely.
About things that have been why do you, if you've not seen Jeff's videos, he does present them in a staccato fashion. Why do you present them in a staccato fashion, Jeff?
Well, I try to enunciate my words properly because I know that there's a text reader, speech to text for YouTube, and also it's my demographic listeners tend to be at the upper end of the age bracket, and they're the hard of hearing, so they need the words to be articulated, and so I do try to enunciate them better than I would normally, you know.
I remember when I started my channel, which was a 2019, I thought I should have a catchphrase. And somehow, hello, 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 which I probably got from the laughing policeman or something, I don't know, seemed like a good idea. Did you think the same way, that you should have a catchphrase?
Well, it just sort of happened. I sat in front of the camera and I thought, well, how do I start this? And a friend of mine had used, in a speech, had just said, hello there. And I thought, well, that seems fair enough. So I just said, hello there, with a big smile. And then you go into a scowl, you know, you sort of go like this because you're delivering serious sort of. So it just stuck. In fact, there was one video I did where I was so angry, I forgot to say hello there. And the comments underneath.
That has happened to me.
Yes.
That has happened to me. I've been so, I think it was when it was the riots.
Yeah.
And Keir Starmer's reaction to it. And I was genuinely furious and it came across. And I just went straight into it.
Yeah. And then you get a right rollicking online for, where's your hello there? You know, where is it? Mm. So they expect you to always stick. And it's like the red curtain I have as well. I thought, oh, I'll change this round. What I'll do is I'll try a purple one. Another rollicking, never changed the red curtain since.
They like the reassuring presence and the permanence and the lack of change, like an Orthodox church.
Yes.
Okay, now obviously, I've watched quite a few of your videos. We know what you talk. Hopefully, if you're not familiar with them, go and have a look. Jeff talks about the pertinent issues of our time, you know, mass immigration and whatever. And you're also involved campaigning, aren't you, with sort of Tommy and people
I never used to campaign. In fact, I was sort of almost apolitical, I would have thought. And I'd leant towards the Tories, you know, sort of safe pair of hands, look after the economy like they once had a reputation for doing. And one day I just heard David Cameron stand up and say, we don't need a referendum. We know what's best for the people. We're not going to have a referendum on leaving the EU. So I straight away went online and signed up for UKIP and became a campaigner.
When was that?
That was February 2013.
And your channel started in 2009, didn't it?
Oh, yeah, but that was just mucking around. So I never really did much with it until one day, because I ran a blog, a written blog at the time, which is now, it's finished. We don't use it anymore, a long time ago. And I suddenly realised that the few videos that I had made were actually earning a little bit of money, a bit more per 1,000 views or whatever you want to call it, than the blog was. And I thought, I'm missing a trick here, and started sort of putting up more regular videos just to see what happened. And I was very lucky to get, I was already monetized because the rules were different in those days. You didn't have to rack up loads of hours and loads of, they just sort of invited you and you just got monetized. It's far easier back then. But I tripped over the monetization rules nicely just as they brought the rules in. And it was around about the time of the great referendum, when they were trying to reverse the referendum, you know, so straight after 2016, when I saw what the politicians were doing, House of Lords, the media, and I thought, I've got to do something. So I started putting up a short video every single day on Brexit, you know, and what they were doing to try and reverse it, because I was very angry about that.
Mm.
So I just that's how it all really started for me in a big way.
And so then how did it become more kind of involved with other figures and your campaign? Because I first met you at Parliament Square last year at Tommy's film showing.
Yeah.
So how did you end up getting more and more involved with other fellow travellers?
I don't know, really. It sort of just came about because I thought that I was in my bubble. I live in Dorset, which is miles away from the centre in London. And I thought, I've got to start going to London and start engaging with these things. So I started doing things like the ULEZ. I went to a few of those, the anti-lockdown stuff and all that sort of stuff. I was involved in that. But basically, I just looked at anything. And I thought, if I thought it was twisted the wrong way, I would campaign on it. And one of these is, as you say, is Tommy. I mean, he's not perfect by any means. Tommy Robinson is not perfect, but I've met him, and he's got a heart of gold when it comes to the country. He really has. And you can, when he's talking about these things, it's not about him. He doesn't talk about himself. He talks about what he can do and what he's going to do to help the country and help people. Because if you look at his past, he's actually done quite a lot of things for people who've been forgotten by society. You know, he bought an electric wheelchair for one young kid. And things like that raises money for these sorts of things. And you go to a rally and they pass buckets around so that they can, for specific things, you know, to try and raise money for the victims of the groomers and all the rest of it.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, I look at this and I think, well, okay, on a balance, yeah, okay, he's done a few stupid things, but on a balance, you know, he's sort of on the right side, I would say, rather than the wrong. And this whole sentence of 18 months reduced to 9 showing a film, okay, yes, contempt of court, that is a serious thing. If you show contempt of court and you get away with it, more people become contemptuous of court. But it works both ways. You can't have a court that's contemptuous of the people. And we seem to be straying a little bit into that sort of territory with the way that they treated the far-right rioters, as it were. I think they overstepped the mark. I think Yvette Cooper was almost committing contempt of court herself by telling everybody, oh, we're going to arrest those people and their pictures up and everything. You know, these people hadn't even been to court yet. We're going to throw them in prison. We're going
to... Yeah, that's pressure in the judiciary to say that you will be tried and you will be found guilty and you will go to prison. That's the judge's discretion. Whether they're found guilty should be a matter for the jury. That is interfering with the system. It was unbelievable.
Yes, it is. And there's one thing that you keep hearing about the judiciary. They were first people to claim in the country. They will always claim, we are independent. That's what they tell you, that we are independent. I didn't see much independence when Keir Starmer turned round and basically ordered them to lock these people up for as long as possible. If that had been several individual instances, they'd have been sent home. you know, with a rap on the knuckles or something, or a suspended sentence, not 2 years inside, for a hurty words. I know some of them did do some pretty nasty physical stuff. And yes, they should be inside. But even then, I'd argue, I think the sentences were over.
And often they pled guilty, which they shouldn't have done. So this woman, Lucy Connolly?
Yes, yes.
Pled guilty. She had no business pleading guilty. And it was absurd. Well,
you plead guilty on the advice of your solicitor. But if you can't afford a solicitor, you get a duty solicitor from the police. So I'm wondering, I'm not making any aspersions here, but there must be a big question mark over the advice those people got from their solicitors. Really must be, you know. And bear in mind that once you've pleaded guilty, there's no jury. It's straight in front of the judge to decide the sentence. So unlike the guy who did the Labour councillor who did this on film.
Yes.
You remember him? I can't remember
his
name.
The Labour councillor in Bristol, isn't it?
Yeah, and he did that. I don't even think his court case has come up yet. You know, did he plead innocent or something? I can't remember now. But nothing seems to have happened there.
They were fast-tracked with the courts, that's the point.
The others were, yes, but he wasn't.
Yeah.
So why not?
And you know, of course, that to be a KC these days, you have, and therefore indirectly to be a judge, you have to show commitment on your application to be a KC to multiculturalism.
Yes.
And show that you've helped
cremate. Yes.
So you're basically biasing it in favour of left-wing judges.
Yes, and then you also find those same sort of people arrive on places like sentencing councils, so that they then decide that, you know, if you're like me, then you don't get any help at all. But so, yeah, it's a two-tier system, and it's growing. We need to really, there should just be a one-tier system. You go in front of the judge, and the judge should be totally colorblind and religious blind and all the rest of it. You've broken the law, this, and I'm going to send you down for that.
Judges should be politically neutral.
Yes.
And they shouldn't be members of political parties. And if you're supporting multiculturalism, that's a political statement.
It is.
So you're not politically neutral.
Yeah.
So the impartiality of the judiciary is gone.
Yeah.
But worse than that, I have a friend, for example, who's a barrister, and he's thinking of applying to become a KC. And he was thinking, what are you supposed to do to get this experience promoting multiculturalism?
Yeah.
And they all find some way of some form of words, I know, something they can put on the application. So to some extent, they don't mean it, and it's window dressing. But they shouldn't have to do it.
No. But then it gets sort of filtered through the whole system. They get used to doing it. And then they, you know, all the training people undergo to drive them in that direction so that when they do their job, the first thing that happens is that it kicks in. So they're there saying, oh, right, I've got to do this. I've got to follow those guidelines. And with the sentencing council, the recent guidelines they came out with, why were they written that way? To be biased because of all the training they've had. Everything tells them to do it. Even politicians are telling them to do it because they spout about it in the House of Commons and the House of Lords. It is top-down driven. And the march through the institutions has been very, very successful. Oh, it's taken a long time, but they've been very, very successful.
Yes, I was talking to you, as you know as well, Ben Habib, earlier, and he made the very good point that it's 30 years since, or a bit over 30 years, since Blairism. And the change to things like freedom of expression, freedom of association, has all been so fundamental. It's a revolution. And that has happened by stealth, which can be reversed, but it would be so difficult that no one seems to have the gumption to do it.
Yeah, but it's also written into all the laws as well.
But that's the thing. It's the Equalities Act essentially gave us a constitution via an Act of Parliament.
Yeah,
and that's not the Equalities Act, the adoption of the European Court of Human Rights Convention.
Yes,
that's it. That gives us
the Human Rights Act.
Human Rights Act. That gives us a constitution, and then the things that used to be in the remit of members of Parliament have gone to quangos.
Yes.
So suddenly you've just neutered democracy completely and put it in the hands of technocrats.
Well, what happens is that it's too difficult for politicians. So the first thing they'll do is offload it. So they want to offload the responsibility like they've just shut down NHS England, haven't they? That's a big quango. And and they're going to take all the decision-making from that quango back into government. But they should do it with a lot more quangos because the the government can turn around and say, well, the Quango said that, we didn't, you know, that, and which is exactly what they've done with the Sentencing Council, which is effectively a Quango. They did that. They said, oh, that's the Sentencing Council. We can't do anything about that. We'll have to legislate, and it's going to take ages to do it. You know, it's rubbish like that. And the Human Rights Act, a lot of people don't realise that whenever a new act or a new bill is put before Parliament, it has to have a statement at the bottom that says this bill is in accordance with the ECHR, basically. It has to say, says that at the bottom. And if it's not, it has to say it's not in accordance with human rights.
Right.
Yes. So at the bottom of the bill. Now, that is used as an ammunition to say we shouldn't even present that bill. So any bill to change the Human Rights Act or to abolish it would have to have underneath it a statement. Now, what would that statement be? If it said this is against human rights, my own bill that I'm putting forward, says the Secretary of State, is against human rights, everyone's going to shout it down.
The human rights, it's like the term pro-life, or it's manipulative. It's a deliberately manipulative term presented in such a way, or anti-racism.
Yeah.
A highly manipulative term, so that you, of course, you don't want to say that you're not anti-racist.
No.
Or that you're not pro-life. Mm. So it's a highly manipulative term in order to shut down debate.
Yes.
It's what human rights are.
Yes. So at the end of the day, the only human rights that you have or I have are ones that I personally can 100% protect. That's it. If you can't 100% protect the human rights that you supposedly have, you haven't got them. If you have to rely on other people who may or may not step in, then where are your rights? What are your rights? And I would argue that we have some privileges that can be taken away from us at certain stages, because emergencies can wipe out all these human rights laws immediately for a certain length of time. They aren't rights. And we need to sort of understand that. It's like the right to free speech. Everyone says, oh, free speech, free speech. We have controlled speech in this country. Controlled. There are words you can use, phrases you can use, words you can't use, and phrases you can't use. And that's it. So if you try to stray outside that box, you can either be cancelled or at worst go to prison. So we don't have free speech. Now, how much you restrict that speech is the real issue. That's the real issue. Not free speech or no free speech.
I think even worse is there's how much it's restricted in law, and there's how much it's de facto restricted.
Yes.
And if you can lose your job and the government doesn't step in and protect you because of things you've said, then that is essentially an example of you not really having free
speech.
Correct. So if you can lose your job for campaigning for a certain political party, let's say, and the government doesn't stop that, then you don't have the freedom, really, to campaign for that political
party. Especially if that political party is actually on the Electoral Commission roll. If it's a registered political party, pays its dues, and does everything legally, then everybody should be able to
I mean, wasn't it amazing under New Labour that they brought in a law that if you were a member of the British National Party, you couldn't work as a fireman, you couldn't work as a prison officer, and you couldn't work as a police officer? They essentially said we have a democracy, we have multiple political parties, but you will be a second-class citizen if you're a member of that party.
Yes. They either ban the party or don't, and do it properly. These are the sorts of things that we really do need to sort out in this country. We're going around, it's all woolly. Everything's woolly defined on purpose so they can catch you out. It's just a gotcha sort of setup, and it gotchas a lot of people.
And they want you to they want you to be caught out. It's like political speed cameras. The purpose of the speed cameras near where I live in northern Finland is you go through this little municipality called IIE. They don't make much money. It's just farmers and whatever. Mm. So they think, how can we make money? We'll put as many speed cameras as possible in as many places as possible and make it difficult for you if you're going at 70 kilometers an hour to get down to 50 in time.
Yeah.
So we can make money. That's part of it. It's ways to catch you out.
Yes.
Bloody hate speed cameras. You drive.
Oh, I do drive, yes. Yeah, I drive and I've got a motorbike as well. So
my dad, he was going at 20... 5 miles an hour in a 20-mile-an-hour zone. Yeah. It's very hard to drive at 20 miles an hour. I mean, you might as well walk.
Yeah.
And he's to avoid a fine, he has to go on an online course about speeding and safety.
Yeah. Yeah.
And he's 72 years old.
Yeah.
It's absolutely ridiculous. You can't drive at 20 miles an hour.
I know. It's in fact, it's more dangerous as far as I'm concerned because I'm constantly looking at the speedo because your brain is telling you all the time when you're driving. Generally, for most people, it's saying, I can drive safely on this road at this speed. And when you feel uncomfortable, you slow down. That's how it works. It's a risk factor in your own head. So if I was just to drive through London, in some places I'd be going at 10 miles an hour because my brain is telling me that. Other places I'd be doing 30 because it's safe to do so. But what we're being told is no. Your brain is just defective in this manner. You must drive right down there. So, in fact, it's all about getting you on public transport and all the rest of it, really.
It's about fining you. It's about making money.
And that as well.
You've got these roads that were 30 miles an hour for the whole history of speed limits.
Yeah.
And then suddenly they're 20. I mean, it's about making money.
Yeah. Go through Wales. It's even worse in Wales. Most of it just seems to be 20 now. Everything, you know. So it takes ages because my channel co-pilot, Richard, he lives in Wales. And I go to see him. He comes to see me. It takes longer now to get to see him because of all the 20 mile an hour zones.
They need to be the first to go. On a completely unrelated, and I'm not even going to segue this. Hang on, let me come up with a way of doing so. Hang on. Going slowly. Boats go slowly. I note that you were a naval man.
Yeah.
Let's go back in time. Let's talk about the chap behind the YouTube channel. I think people might like to know about that. I certainly do. So you're from originally...
Reading area.
Berkshire.
Yeah.
Berkshire, well, village in Reading, is it?
Yeah, Burfield.
Burfield.
Burfield Common, yeah.
And then you go to school there, did you do after you left school?
Well, I always wanted to join the military. So I, in the end, plumped for the Navy. I went on an apprentice course.
I was 16?
I was 17, I stayed on for a bit to do A-levels, but then I got a bit... I just wanted to go and join, so I did. I'm not sure they still run the same scheme. It's called the Artificer Apprentice Scheme, where they train you to either become a mechanical technician or an electrical technician. It's sort of the same sort of thing as a Rolls-Royce apprenticeship. It was very highly regarded. And you went to sea as well and travelled the world while you were doing it.
This is Merchant Navy. This is the
Royal Navy. Yeah. So it was a 5-year apprenticeship, so it's a long one. But it taught you so much. The Royal Navy and the Armed Forces taught me so much about sort of self-discipline, reining yourself in a bit, except on weekends. And I had a great life. I did that, finished the apprenticeship, went on to my first ship, and then was sent to Dartmouth to train to become a naval officer in Britannia Royal Naval College, Dartmouth.
Mm-hmm.
And that was another experience. So I spent the first five,
did
seven...
Did the King go to Dartmouth? Who was it to Dartmouth?
I assume so. I mean, I don't know. I think he did, yeah. They all would have done, unless... I think the only one who didn't was one of them went to Lympstone because they became a Marine.
Andrew.
Yes. Was that Andrew?
Yeah, Andrew was a Marine, I think.
Okay.
I
think it was Edward, wasn't it?
Edward,
I think. I can't remember.
Yeah, you're probably
so
right.
A long time ago. But, I did all that. But you get very, not blinkered, but you get sort of focused on the Navy or in the armed forces in general. And that's your life. It runs everything. You're on call 24/7. You don't get overtime pay. You know, you could work for a month or not, and you still get paid the same. It was quite fun because you get a phone call now and again. Oh, we need someone to run off over here for 3 or 4 days and do that. Or one time I got a phone call saying, do you fancy going to the former Republic of Yugoslavia on the on the UN peacekeeping force. Yes, please, I'll go. And he was arguing with me on the phone. He was saying, it is really good for... I said, listen, you're pushing at an open door. Because most of the people he was talking to were saying, no, I don't want to go. But I said, no, I'll go. And so I went out to a former... And I was a naval officer with a gun. I had a pistol and an SA-80, a 9mm and a SA-80. Very dangerous naval officers with guns. They're all right with torpedoes, but not with guns.
So what kind of places other than Yugoslavia did you go on tours of?
Well, it's you go out on a ship and you visit loads of different places. I was on a ship called HMS Antrim at one stage. It was a guided missile cruiser. Well, it was called a destroyer for budgetary purposes, but it was very big. And we went to the West Indies and we just travelled around there for a while. But I went across there on a submarine as well. Oh, it's great in submarines. I'm not sure if they still do this, but when you visit a place in a submarine is so compact that you can't actually have a comfortable life in it. You can't live in it when it's alongside. So they put us up in hotels. So you go to the Bahamas, Bermuda, or wherever, and park alongside, and you're bussed off to the hotels. Thank you very much.
Yeah. Nice hotels.
And yes, and you get given subsistence money to buy your food.
Oh, okay.
So you just go out and, yeah. So that was quite a nice little arrangement.
And what rank did you ascend to in the...
Oh, I ended up as a lieutenant commander. I left in the year 2000, at the end of 2000, after just shy of 26 years.
Okay, what made you want to leave? Was it age? Or...
No. It was I'd got to the end of any promotion prospects and all the rest of it, and I thought, well, you know, I've had a good life. I'm going to move on to another phase. I could have stayed and I could have had interesting jobs, but I wanted to do something else. I'd got to that stage. I'm not a high flyer in the Navy, then I'll go and do something else. And I went and joined the NHS for a while, and I thought I was swapping another big, well-run, well-oiled organisation for another one. Didn't quite work out like that for me. I found it very disjointed in some ways. Healthcare is so, so complex. You know, being a sailor, sink the ship, you know. it's a bit more complex than that. But healthcare has got so many different... even having a doctor who retires in one speciality, suddenly you've got a hole there in that speciality. So then you've got to start firing patients off elsewhere while you try and find a new doctor. It's not like there's any succession. It's not easy for succession planning. It's not easy. And then that goes for, and suddenly you find that some nurses leave and you've got to get bank nurses in at high cost. That hits the budget. It's a very, very, very complex thing.
Were you ever actually in a proper combat situation where you had to sink a ship?
I was in a combat. I was sent down to the Falklands on HMS Sheffield.
Oh, you were in the Falklands?
Yes, so I went down to the Falklands in 1982, yeah. We'd just come back from a deployment to the Middle East, and we came back and we dropped off in Gibraltar. And we had a big sports thing weekend. But during that time, the Argentine forces took the Falkland Islands, and we were told to prepare. And instead of coming out of the Straits of Gibraltar and turning right, we came out and turned left. So the fleet started gathering as we slowly made our way down. But it's one of the things that not a lot of people realise is that from day one to the end, when that white flag was flying over Port Stanley, that took 74 days. That's all it took, 74 days. And we had to go halfway around the world with a fleet, put together a fleet of Royal Navy and ships taken up from trade, stuffed, they call it, with civilians and all the rest of it. We had to get the aircraft, everything had to work. And one of the most amazing things was the RAF when they bombed the airport on the Falklands to stop the Argentine Air Force using it. And it took loads and loads and loads and loads of refuelers. And there's a great video on YouTube going through this whole operation. absolutely time critical down to the second. The RAF played a blinder. I don't say that often.
Now, before we continue, I'd like to tell you what's been quite exciting. I know that you Generation Z people want to know all of the base knowledge. You want to read all of the base books, but you don't really like reading. So what if there was an app that would take those books, summarise them for you in less than 25 minutes and read them to you? Well, fortunately, such an app exists, and it's called Legion.com. And, oh, what's that? That's my new book, Woke Eugenics, which argues that wokeness is a selection event that will make us genetically fit once again. There's the book. Click on it. And you can hear it read in my voice. Well, I mean, like, sort of my voice, AI version, but sort of... But basically my voice. And then it can be summarised for you and you can imbibe the base knowledge. It can be injected straight from your phone, baseness, straight from your phone into your brain box. And if you sign up today and use the code TJH, then you can get a 10% reduction. So that's Legion.com. All the base knowledge straight from your phone into your brain box.
So, but were you in a situation where that you... You know, life-threatening sort of situation?
Well, yeah, because the Sheffield got sunk, I was on it.
You're very modest about these interesting things that happen to you. I have to kind of pursue you. You go on from being in the Navy to being in the NHS without telling me. You go into being in the ship to not telling me that it was sunk. Right. So tell me what happened.
Okay. Because I was under training, and there were four midshipmen on board. I was one of them, and we were under training, and we were off on. You know, we were coming back. We were meant to go on the big warfare course when we got back. No, and the Captain Sam Salt, who sadly died of cancer a few 10, 15 years ago, I think now, he said, no, they'll get more warfare training coming down there than they will. So he insisted we stay, which was fine by us. You know, we didn't mind. We thought it was great going down. And it's when you get down there and we were the first to be hit. I don't think anybody expected it, but we were hit by an Exocet missile on the starboard side, took out the hydraulics and the water main. We were dead in the water and there was nothing we could do. And the smoke was pouring out of everything. I mean, I was taking a crafty nap in my cabin with where was all four midshipmen together in the cabin we were. And I think if I remember rightly, yes, I think we were, when there was this massive bang. And we thought, what was that? And looked out, I poked my head out the cabin door and there was smoke already coming out from one of the hatches. It was just smoke was pouring out. So I just ran straight up to the bridge, which was my emergency station. But there was no one there because as soon as it hit, they lost control from the bridge. So they had to go to the secondary bridge. But there was so much smoke and they couldn't do anything. No one could talk to anybody. So it was very, very difficult.
And what happened?
Right. Then two ships came alongside. HMS Arrow came on the port side, which I jumped onto with a load of others because that was upwind. So just slow, well, up breeze.
So what did you do? You put a gangplank between
the ships? No. We just, it was quite hairy, I would say, because we were stationary in the water. So they had to come alongside and stop with us. Now, the ship, the Sheffield, could have gone up, could have just bang, which it didn't. It could have done. No one knew if it would or wouldn't. And ship Arrow came alongside, and it's very difficult to explain. The two ships' hulls were doing this all the time, almost touching. They were that close, you know, with the waves. So you just timed your jump and you jumped across. But just before I went, the navigator of the ship, he jumped across but slipped. And he grabbed hold of the handrail on the Arrow and his legs were dangling down. And just then this happened, you know, came in. And I was 10 yards away. There was nothing I could do.
And he was crushed?
Nope. Then it pulled apart.
Oh.
And he scrambled up. I mean, it was so close. That was, but so we jumped across onto that. Then everybody talked about, well, which ships are we going to go to? But they soon realised that the ships were fully manned in the fleet and that putting us into another ship, it would just get in the way. And so what they decided was that a couple of people would be deployed where there were shortages. The rest of us would be taken on to a ship called the British Esk, which was one of these tankers taken up from trade. And then we were then dropped off at Ascension and flown back. But it took its time. There were no rush to get us back because they needed the British Esk there until it was fully empty of oil, you know, to tanker all the other ships. So that finished. And that was a civilian ship that was adapted quickly for refueling ships at sea.
Wow.
Yeah, it's yeah, and I've had, you know, a few other things. Well, I'll tell you a couple of things. Surfacing at the North Pole in a nuclear submarine, done that. These are the things that the military do, and as you said, I do treat it as matter of fact.
You had to be a separately trained submariner.
Yes,
so you are that as well.
Yes.
Okay.
So the whole point about the military is you do these really outlandish things. But you're doing them all the time. So it's, you know, it's just normal. And when you talk to people about it, they're sort of shocked that you've actually done that sort of thing. One of the things, part of the training was in Portlandville, we used to have a naval base there. And that's where
South Dorset.
Yeah, South Dorset. And they used to have a naval base there which did the warfare training at sea. So you'd have a big exercise to the south of Dorset, you know, in the sea, and everything, all the ships buzzing around, aeroplanes and submarines, when we used to have a load of ships, submarines and aeroplanes. And they were, so you're exercising off the coast there. And one of the things, I was sent to Yeovil, sat in, what were the Hawker Hunters, they used to use jets, and sat in the passenger seat. And we were sent out to bomb the fleet, you know, or pretend to be low-flying missiles. And at one stage, I was sat there and I was in this thing. And there's a thing called a 90-90 seat. It's an ejector seat. And they have to arm it. And they say, the seat is now armed. If you touch anything, it will go whoosh. The trouble is you have to be at 90 feet or 90 knots going forward to have enough speed for you to reach the ground safely. If you were to let one of these things off while you're sat still on the ground, it will take you up and plonk you dead on the ground in a heap. So you sat there very carefully with this, because, you know. Oof. Anyway, we took off, and the pilot sort of some stage as we got out, so he said, right, you have control. All right, okay. And he said, I want you to take you down. And he made me come right down until I thought the waves were going to, you know, he said, there, keep it there. And as I was like this, you know, rabbit in the head, charging towards these ships. And I kept trying to edge the stick up, you know, to bring the nose up, to bring us up to a sensible height. And he just went like that.
What vehicle are you in?
This was in the Hawker Hunter jet.
In a jet, yeah.
I was, yeah.
Right, so you also trained to fly?
No. This was just to give you an experience of what it's like.
Right.
And those are the sorts of things we used to do.
Okay.
Then he said, just keep going at the ship, keep going at the ships, keep going up the ships. And he told me when to lift, you know, to miss them, because otherwise I'd have gone straight through the side. It was. And then when we came back, there were two of them, and there was a friend of mine as a passenger in the other jet doing the same sort of thing. And we turned back towards Yeovil. Did we land there? I can't remember now. But we haired back. And it started getting very cloudy and foggy. And I thought, oh, right, so we'll have to separate so that radar can bring us in. No. They got together. So that one wingtip was there.
Right
next to me. Because then they can see each other.
Was there two of you in the plane?
There was the pilot.
The pilot and the
and myself, yeah. In the co-pilot seat.
Right,
such.
Right.
Yeah, it was a trainer type thing. And, it was interesting. And then they landed in tandem on the same runway, like that, side by side.
So before you were in the Falklands, you were in the Middle East, you said?
Yeah, that was a bit of that was just a journey, a deployment in them, yeah.
To do what? What do they send the Royal Navy in to do in these places?
Show the flag, be there. It's all about, you know, sea lanes and projecting soft power defence, all that sort of thing. And we had interests. We used to have the Chagos Islands, remember? Mm. Yeah, things like that. I think we stopped off there, if I remember rightly. Can't remember now. So long ago. I just don't think about these things so much now.
So this was the 80s that you were in the...
Yeah. I joined the Navy.
2000.
I joined the Navy in 1975, and I left in the year 2000, the beginning of 75 and in the end of 2000.
Right, yeah. Okay.
Yeah.
So you weren't in Northern Ireland or anything like that?
No,
you were
no.
You too young for that?
No, I was... Well, no. Younger people than me would have gone there. Yeah, no, the Navy did have a presence there, patrolling the coast between the north and south to see if they could catch any gun runners and things like that. We used to have one of those. That's a long, long time ago. I'm not sure they do that anymore. I don't think they do. And if I had been selected for some reason to go, in fact, it was almost impossible because as soon as I became a submariner, that was it, you know, especially nuclear, because they don't want you falling into the wrong hands for obvious reasons, because we used to do a long, sort of a 3-month nuclear engineering course. How does a nuclear submarine work? Yeah, that's one of the things that people may not realise, that to become a submariner, you actually have to do a load of courses before you even set foot inside one. And then you have to learn the submarine inside out, every pipe, every nozzle, every latch, everything, you know, all about the hydraulics, all about the air, all about the periscopes, everything. And you're tested on it. And and you have to pass all these tests. It's quite rigorous. And one of the things you had to do back then, and I'm not sure it happens now because I think it used to take place in HMS Dolphin. There was a big 100-metre high tower full of water, and it had three entry points, one at 10 metres, sorry, it was 30 metres, 100 feet, 30 metres. So it had a 10-metre entry point, 20-meter entry point, and a 30-meter entry point. So you could practice escaping from a submarine in an emergency. And how would you do it? And they train you how to blow out while you're deep. So as you rise to the surface, your lungs don't explode. So they take you through all of this and the mechanics of an escape chamber and all the rest of it. And that,
What's an escape chamber?
In every submarine, there is usually fore and aft. There's an area that's designated. It's like the front end of a submarine where the torpedoes are. That becomes an escape chamber in an emergency. If everything else floods, people can go
in. That's where you go in. You can shut it.
Yeah. There's doors all the way through.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I remember I'm speaking from 25 years ago. So my memory is a bit hazy.
I'm speaking as well as I've never been in a submarine.
Yeah, okay. And so the idea is that there's a place you can go to which is sealed off, and then there's a hatch you can open and you can escape to the surface. Now, there's loads and loads of things that can go wrong. It's, you know, it's fraught with danger. And the first thing you think about is equalising the pressure, because you're deep down. If you stay pressurised too long, you'll come up with the bends. Also, if your ears don't clear, you can come up to the surface with blown eardrums and stuff like that. And when you do rise to the surface, unless you're in a specially designed suit, then you've had time to put on a specially designed suit, you have to blow out all the way to the surface and blow hard. So you don't go like that and just go up, and because your lungs, the air just expands as the pressure goes down. And you'll go boof, and there'll be blood everywhere. So you have to blow out hard all the way. So you know, really hard, and you go
in
out.
In water?
Yep, while you're under, and they train you to do it, because it's so, what's the word, anti-intuitive. Your instinct is hold my breath, but if you do, you die. So you have to blow out, and they make you do it in the chamber. They push you into a small room, very small, tight, 10 of you. Out one by one, you're dragged out into the water. Yeah. And then they hold you until you start blowing.
What are you wearing on your head while you're doing this?
Sorry?
What are you wearing on your head while you're doing this in the water and you're escaping the chamber? Nothing.
Nothing.
So you're in water trying to do this.
Yeah, before they let you go.
That's such a bizarre thing to do. Yep. In water,
yeah.
You just...
Yes, I know. And they have to train you how to overcome that.
God.
Yeah, I mean, those are the sorts of things. So, but they... It's very well structured. I'm not sure they do this anymore, but it was very well structured because they gave you 2 days of classroom training before you did it and they bored you to death with it. So in the end, you knew it all rough rote and yeah, I've heard this 3 times already. And then you're bored. And then when you get in the chamber, it's just sort of do it. But I had, when I was joined the Navy, we did some training and it involved some boxing. They wanted just to box. And one guy hit me rather cleanly on the ear, compressed it, and I blew an eardrum. That was, and so it's always caused me just a little bit of problems. So I went into the tank the first time, not a problem. The next time I went into the tank, it was really, really, it was agonizing. So I couldn't complete that course, the second one, but they signed me off anyway because I'd done it before. But so, yeah. We do all these interesting things in the military. Join the military. It's great fun.
Well, my grandfather was called up when he was 20, He was 19, he was called up. And he just didn't want to die. That was his attitude. So the first thing he was asked.
Are you ready for the future of the West?